Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming to learn, continuing to learn after Kollel is over. It's really always inspiring to see that there are guys that want to keep on learning, bridging the Kollel with the school year, Bez Hashem, where you're going to keep it going, keep that fire and that passion for Talmud Torah going and making sure that it's part of your daily schedule. So what we're going to talk about today is a topic in halacha, but it really starts with a story. And really, there was a personality behind this topic in halacha. Let me just tell you what the topic in halacha is first, and then we'll backtrack to the story and how the story played into this topic in halacha. This year, if I'm correct, I think Rosh Chodesh is tomorrow and Friday, which means that really Aleph Elul is Friday, which means Beis Elul is Shabbos, which means 4 weeks later, from Beis Elul, is what? Is Rosh Hashanah, right? Good. So 4 weeks from this Shabbos is Rosh Hashanah, which means Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos. Now, when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, we have 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, so it's never going to be, lo adu Rosh. The first day of Rosh Hashanah doesn't fall out on Sunday, doesn't fall out on Wednesday, and doesn't fall out on Friday. So if one of the days of Rosh Hashanah is Shabbos, you know that it's always the first day of Rosh Hashanah is Shabbos. And then the second day of Rosh Hashanah is going to be Sunday, yeah? So that's what we're going to have this year. So how does that change our Rosh Hashanah in any way, other than that you miss less school? How does it change your Rosh Hashanah? Shofar, right? Meaning we don't blow shofar on Shabbos. So the halachic issue we're going to talk about today is not the fact that we don't blow shofar on Shabbos. That's well documented. We know that we don't blow shofar on Shabbos. However, what is less well documented and what is less clear is whether, if they put together a Beis Din in Yerushalayim, whether they should blow shofar in Yerushalayim in a Makom Beis Din on Shabbos, even B'zman Hazeh. And there was a movement, I don't know if you can call it a movement, but there was a very powerful personality at some point in history, which we'll learn about today, who made a huge push that when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, that they should put together a Beis Din, get together in Yerushalayim, and have shofar blown on Shabbos, on Rosh Hashanah, Shechalios B'Shabbos. And the question became, okay, so you can have this one guy that's doing this, right? This one guy that's blowing shofar, and we'll get to what his halachic reasoning is and why he thought that that was a good idea and why he thought you were even allowed to do that. But there was going to be one person that's doing this. Should we go and listen? I'm not going to blow shofar on Shabbos because that's crazy, right? Meaning that seems like it might be a violation of some sort of iser. But once somebody's doing it, should I listen? Should I try to make it my business to get there? What would be the benefit of doing that? I'll get the mitzvah of shofar. Meaning, if I'll tell you one thing for sure, if I don't hear shofar on Shabbos, I'm definitely not getting the mitzvah of shofar. I'm not supposed to, because we're not supposed to blow shofar on Shabbos, but I'm definitely not getting the mitzvah. But maybe if somebody's doing it, I'm getting the mitzvah. So this is a halachic issue that wasn't really widely discussed in modern times until there was a Jew by the name of Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger who came along. So Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger is probably a name that you don't know particularly well. He's not, for some reason, for whatever reason, a variety of reasons, his svarim are not widely learned in yeshivas nowadays, but he's a fascinating person. Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger was someone who lived from 1837 to 1922, so in the latter part of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. 1870, he made Aliyah, he moved to Eretz Yisrael, and he was, by the time he moved to Eretz Yisrael, he was already a known Talmud Chacham. He was a Talmud of his father. His father was his only real Rebbe. Well, I shouldn't say that. He was a Talmud of the Ksav Sofer as well. His father was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer. So he was brought up in this Hungarian style of Judaism, of Orthodox Judaism, that was very intense, was not very into innovation. The Chasam Sofer very famously made it like a mantra that Chadash Asr Min HaTorah, that any innovations in Judaism that are being suggested and implemented by the Reform movement, by others, it's Asr Min HaTorah to change the way we practice Judaism. And he was educated in that way, in that style. And nevertheless, he also attended 4 years of secular school, and he learned to read and write in German, and he mastered mathematics, and he was very strong in math, and he was a little more educated secularly than the typical person who would have been a student of the Chsam Sofer or the Ksav Sofer. He had some falling out with the Ksav Sofer at some point. He had gotten engaged to the Ksav Sofer's niece, and the Ksav Sofer wasn't happy about the Shidduch. He ended up getting married to somebody else. Turned out that after the Ksav Sofer's wife died, the Ksav Sofer married Rav Schlesinger's sister. So it was complicated. The whole family situation was like, they ended up living in like the same house. I don't know. It was till he made Aliyah. It was a complicated family situation. But that's where he came from. So then this Rav Kiv Yosef Schlesinger makes Aliyah. But before he made Aliyah, he published a sefer called Lev HaIvri. Lev HaIvri was originally published not as its own sefer. It was called Tzava'as Moshe V'nilve Elav Sefer Lev HaIvri. That what they published was Tzava'as Moshe. Tzava'as Moshe was the Tzava'a of the Chsam Sofer. What's a Tzava'a? What's the English for Tzava'a? How would you translate Tzava'a? Last will and testament, except most of the times when you write a will, right, it's like, my house in Woodmere is going to go to this child, and my apartment in Yerushalayim is going to go to that child, and my car is going to go to that child, and my severe anxiety is going to go to all my children, and my, you're dividing up your estate, you're dividing up your stuff. A tzava is not so much about the stuff, it's about, because for many, many years, didn't have stuff. We didn't have very much. So the tzava was really much more about, and we also have dinim of Yerusha that sort of just take care of that, but the tzava was much more about an ethical will. Like, this is what I think is important for my family. These are the things that I think are very critical. You know, there are gedolim that wrote a tzava that you have to learn. If you're going to go into business, I want all my children to learn all of Shulchan Aruch Hashem Mishpat at least once a year. And I want them to, specifically, what they think their children need in order to thrive religiously. So the Chsam Sofer wrote a tzava, and Rav Schlesinger published the tzava of the Chsam Sofer, V'nilve Elav Sefer Nar Ivri. And so, along with it, he also published his own stuff, his own Sefer Nar Ivri. And then later on, he published it again, and this time he did a running commentary on the tzava called Lev Ivri. Ivri, he spelled Ayin Yud Beis Resh Yud, and the reason he spelled it that way is because it's a Rashi Tevas of Akiva Yosef ben Rabbi Yechiel. Right? His name was Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, so Akiva Yosef ben Rabbi Yechiel, Rashi Tevas is Ivri, so that's why he called it Lev HaIvri. So he makes Aliyah, he goes to Eretz Yisrael in 1870. He was hailed as a celebrity when he got there. He was this huge Talmud Chacham, a Talmud of the Ksav Sofer. It was like a big deal when Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, and then he started making trouble. There was a whole system of how people would get supported by learning in Kollel, and all the money would come from Chutz Laretz. There was no startup nation then, there was no money in inherently coming from Eretz Yisrael. There was no economy. The whole economy was donations from Chutz Laretz. You think a lot of money comes from Chutz Laretz, Eretz Yisrael now. It was nothing compared to what it used to be. There was nothing from Eretz Yisrael itself. The whole, because people in the Kollelim in Eretz Yisrael had to divide up all that money among whoever was there, they were discouraging people from making Aliyah because they don't want to divide. I mean, you divide $1,000 10 ways, everybody gets $100. You divide $1,000 1,000 ways, everybody gets a dollar. So they didn't want Aliyah. They were telling people, stay away, we don't want you here. And so how did they do that? They can't tell people stay away. They said, your first 10 years after making Aliyah, we decentivize Aliyah. Your first 10 years, you don't get a portion of the money. Only after a few years of being here, then you get a portion of the money that comes, like the exact opposite of like what the Israeli government does. Right? The Israeli government gives all sorts of incentives. In the first few years, you have this, that, or the other thing that help, then you work with Nefesh B'Nefesh, and it helps grease the wheels of Aliyah. They had the opposite. So Rav Akiva Yosef came to Eretz Yisrael, he said, this is crazy. This whole system is crazy. It's all backwards. We're never going to bring Mashiach this way. He was Zionist in the sense that he believed that we have to push for the coming of Mashiach. We don't just go about our daily lives. We have to do whatever we can in order to push the coming of Mashiach. And so right away, he made a lot of enemies, like immediately. And then he made a bunch more enemies because he had four four very controversial halachic stances, four very controversial things in halacha that he held, and each of them made him a bunch of enemies. So we're going to focus on one of them, but I'll just mention quickly what the four are. One of them is that he tried to undo the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom about marrying multiple wives. Well, that was a mouthful. What was that? What's the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom? Anyone familiar? Anyone hear that? Yeah, what is that? I said marrying multiple wives, right? There is a chair, halachically, on a daraisa level, a person is allowed to marry more than one woman, right? You can Yaakov Avinu was married to four women, right? Halachically, a person is allowed to, on a daraisa level, a person is allowed to marry more than one woman, even on a darabanan level. Rabbeinu Gershom, who lived about 1,000 years ago, came along and made a chairim that you're not allowed to marry more than one wife. That chayrim has been accepted very widely. There are certain branches of Sephardic Jewry that did not accept the chayrim, and even within the last 100 years have been married to more than one wife. But typically now, I think it's the law of the land in Israel, even that no matter what your heritage, no matter where you come from, you're not allowed to marry more than one wife. Good. Rabbi Kivi Yosef Schlesinger said, who says the chayrim is still in effect? Maybe we could undo that chayrim. Why not? Marry more than one wife. Now, well, is he like a glutton for punishment? Like, why would you want to do something like that? That's insane. Meaning, first of all, it's bad for your relationship, obviously. It's totally going against the trend of society and the way marriages work nowadays. What was his motivation? So his motivation was interesting. It used to be that anyone growing up in Russia was drafted into the army. And when you're drafted into the army, it was often for a 25-year time period. It's not like, the Russian army is not like, going into the IDF, where you have a few months which is also very intense, but you have a few months of training, and you go home for Shabbos sometimes, and and you're fighting for something that means something to you. You're fighting for Eretz Yisrael. No, you're drafted into the Russian army. Religion is gone forever. Your life is miserable, and it's 25 years. So what people would often do when they were drafted into the Russian army is they would do whatever they can to flee. They would do whatever they can to get out of there. They would leave Russia. So a lot of times they'd go to Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Kivi Yosef Schlesinger sees all these people, these Russians, coming to Eretz Yisrael, and he would like talk to them, and he would say, do you have a family? Well, I had a family. My wife is in Russia. She didn't want to come, or she wasn't willing to risk it, to make this journey. Did you give her a get? No. We had no one to arrange a get, I'm still technically married to her. And these guys couldn't move on with their lives because they can't get remarried if they didn't give their wife, if they hadn't been able to arrange a get. So he wanted to undo the Chaim Rabbeinu Gershom, not so that a guy can practically be married to two wives, but that they can get remarried. So that was one thing that got him into a whole bunch of trouble. Second thing that got him into a whole bunch of trouble was he was a big fan of Tcheles. Now, Tcheles, I said he died in 1922. We found this Tcheles that we wear nowadays. We didn't find it till like the 1980s or 90s. So what are we talking about? What kind of Tcheles? Does anyone know the history of that? What kind of Tcheles did he wear? The Radziner. So the Radziner Rebbe was a Hasidic Rebbe who thought, before that we found the Mirax Trunculus, he thought he found the Tcheles. And he had an idea of what the real Tcheles was. So he sent letters. He was a big Gadol, the Radziner Rebbe, and he sent letters to all the Gadolei Torah, and he said, who's with me? I think I found the Tcheles, and I think we all need to start wearing Tcheles. So most of the Gadolim said, no, you haven't, or even if you did, we're not going to do it. Or, they had a whole bunch of different responses and questions and whatever. Rav Kivi Yosef Schlesinger was into it. He was like, this is it, and he started wearing the Tcheles. He was very, very into it. In Eretz Yisrael at the time, there was a Talmud of the Kotzker Rebbe, Rav Hillel Meshel Gelbstein, who was very against the Tcheles, and he was a very powerful personality. So he wrote a whole kuntras in very strong terms that we have to reject the Tcheles. Not only that, he tried to get Rav Kivi Yosef Schlesinger thrown off of any rabbinic position because he held that he's an apikores. He says that that anyone who wears the Tcheles is novid avodah zarah. Not sure what the connection between to, but anyone who wears the Tcheles is novid avodah zarah, and as novid avodah zarah, he can't serve as a rabbi, and he sent his people after Rav Schlesinger. So much so that one time Rav Schlesinger was davening in his shul, and a few of the messengers of Rav Gelbstein came into the shul. They ripped his talus off his back because he was wearing tchelis on the talus. They ripped it off his back. A fist fight ensued or whatever. But anyway, they made their way with the talus. They brought it back to their Rebbe, and the Rebbe burnt the talus publicly on the roof of the Churva Shul in the center of the old city of Yerushalayim to make a public show that we have to burn Avodah Zarah and the Tchelos of Avodah Zarah, so he wanted to burn. So these are like, you know, this is the second thing that got Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger into trouble. A third thing that got Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger into trouble was that he wanted to reinstitute bring Karm Pesach Bizman Hazeh. Any problems with that? Well, there's no Beis HaMikdash, but the halacha is technically you can bring Karm Pesach even without a Beis HaMikdash. So the question is, can you get over all the other halachic issues? You know, out of Yom HaZeh, there are people that try to do this. They get stopped somewhere along the way, but there are people that designate a lamb in advance of Pesach, and you could buy it. You go online and buy a lamb in advance of Pesach. They say they'll reserve it for you for Karm Pesach. Now, most people don't do that, but anyone who would do that is doing it al manas, that the Beis HaMikdash comes and that we have the Geula comes and that we're able to do it, but technically you do it without a Beis HaMikdash. Nowadays, like, it would start World War III, and I'm not saying that as a figure of speech, it would literally start World War III if we were to bring a Karban Pesach on the Makom HaMikdash. So we don't do it. But he wanted it. This was before there was a state, before the, it was not really Shaykh anyway, but he wanted to do it. That was another thing that got him into a lot of trouble. A lot of people really didn't like it. And then the fourth thing that got him into a lot of trouble, which is going to be the main topic of what we're going to talk about today for the next half hour or so. And that is, he wanted to institute that we blow shofar on Shabbos. When Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, to blow shofar on Shabbos. Now, why don't we blow shofar on Shabbos? So the Gemara Masechet, the first Mishnah, the fourth parak of Masechet Rosh Hashanah tells us that we don't blow shofar on Shabbos, but the reason we don't blow shofar on Shabbos, the Gemara has a little bit of a back and forth as to why we don't blow shofar on Shabbos. Let's back up a little bit. There is a sefer called Ira Kodesh VaMikdash by Rav Chil Michal Tukachinsky. He's most famous for what? Rav Chil Michal Tukachinsky? You've heard the name, right? What's he famous for? International Dateline or Zmanim, right? If you like eating, you like ending your fast days early, right? You're a big fan of Rav Tukachinsky, right? That's what you sign up for. His Zmanim, you wanna end the fast with his man. So he was a big Talmud Chacham, and he described this whole situation with Rav Schlesinger in his sefer Ira Kodesh VaMikdash. He has a whole sefer about issues that come up relating to Eretz Yisrael and relating to Yerushalayim. So Rav Tukachinsky describes that Rav Schlesinger had a she'ifa to establish Tkiyah Shofar in Yerushalayim on Shabbos. And in 1880, 10 years after making Aliyah, Rav Schlesinger published a little pamphlet, a kuntrus, encouraging people to do this. And what he essentially wanted to do is he wanted to gather together 23 people, form a Sanhedrin, and once you have a Sanhedrin, he said, now you're going to be allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos. It didn't work out because he got 23 people to agree, but they all chickened out. And when the day came and he was trying to get his Sanhedrin together, most of them didn't show up because they had all sorts of threats. If you show up, you're never going to be working in this town again, and things like that. So none of them actually showed up. But supposedly he still blew shofar anyway, even without the benefit of a Sanhedrin, and that he did it in private. So what's all this based on? So following the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishnah tells us Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai made a takana that the shofar should be blown on Shabbos anywhere that there is a Beis Din. That's not me saying that. That's the Mishnah in the first Mishnah, the fourth parak of Masechet Rosh Hashanah. The first Mishnah, the fourth parak of Masechet Rosh Hashanah says, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai made a takana that anywhere that there's a Beis Din, you blow shofar on Shabbos. Which is, wow, that's quite a statement. Anywhere that, then the Mishnah says, maybe only Yavne, maybe, but the simple reading, anywhere that there's a Beis Din. The Rif took that very literally, and he held that even a Beis Din of people who don't have smicha, as long as there's a Beis Din that's an established and recognized Beis Din, you blow shofar on Shabbos in the makom that there is a Beis Din. And they say that the Rif himself did it. That the Rif himself, one of the Gedolei Rishonim, would blow shofar on Shabbos in a makom that there is a Beis Din. However, most of the Rishonim say no. when the Mishnah says that you blow shofar on Shabbos in a makom that has a beis din, what the Mishnah means to say is that we blow shofar on Shabbos in a makom that you have a beis din of musmachim, of people who have actual smicha. Nowadays, nobody has actual smicha. What are you talking about, Rabbi? Aren't you the director of the Smicha, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Smicha program at the Rabbi Isaac Chaim Theological Seminary? Yes, I am. Thank you. But so what does that mean? What am I directing? I'm directing a fake thing? Yeah, totally fake, right? Meaning the real Smicha we don't have anymore. What's I'm not directing anything anyway. I teach. But, you know, real Smicha, what's real Smicha? What's real Smicha? You have Ish Mi Pi Ish from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu passes on the smicha, and it was an unbroken chain. And then guess what happened? The chain is broken. And if the chain is broken, nobody has real smicha anymore. What we have now is something else entirely. What we have now, what we call smicha, it says on the certificate, Yora Yora. It's the right to paskin halachos. We always need people to paskin halachos, no matter what time in history we're living. Jewish people have to observe halacha. In order to observe halacha, you have to be able to know what the halacha is. So we need people who are expert in paskining halachos. That's what we have. Yora, yora, that you get the right. Yora, yora is, really means, yora, can I paskin halacha? Yora, yeah, you can paskin halacha. It's really a question answer. So we paskin halachos nowadays. We don't have the real smicha. The real smicha would allow you to do a lot more than paskin halachos. You could put together a beis din with real smicha that can give someone malchus if he violates a los asei in the Torah. We don't do that. We don't bullwhip somebody if they, if they violate a los asei in the Torah, if they eat some non-kosher food, right? I mean, we don't go into the non-kosher restaurants and say, with two kosher edim, Hasra, don't eat your dinner. And then the person takes a bite, okay, take him out and, you know, bullwhip him 39 times. Right? We don't do that because we can't. We're not allowed to do that. We don't have smicha. You need smicha in order to be able to do that. Historically, there was a time where they tried to reinstitute it, where smicha was lost. After many years of smicha was lost, they did try to reinstitute it. After the Spanish Inquisition, so this goes back 500 years already, there were many people that fled from Spain and went to Eretz Yisrael, and they ended up in Tzfat, and they were very sincere Jews, and they felt that the way they behaved in order to avoid persecution, they did certain things that gave the impression that they were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, that they were Christians, which we view as being Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and they felt that the only way they're going to get kapara for their averus is if they get malchus. So there was a whole group of people that went to the Rabbanim in Tzfat and said that we'd like to get malchus, which is like, you know, not normally the way things work, right? That people ask for malchus. They said, we'd like to get malchus. And the rabbi said, we're sorry, we can't help you. We don't have smicha. We can't, I mean, there's no smicha anymore. So they said, so get smicha, figure something out. So there was a group of rabbis that got together and they found a Rambam where the Rambam paskins that, or seems to paskin, that if all, that even though it needs to be an unbroken chain from Moshe Rabbeinu, Rambam says like, but to rebuild the third base of Migdash, you're going to need musmachim also. You need a Sanhedrin to handle that. Well, how are we going to have musmachim if that happens before Tchias HaMesim? Right? It just doesn't add up, right? Meaning, until you have Tchias HaMesim, we're not going to be able to get smicha from any real musmach. So there's got to be a way, says the Rambam, to reinstitute smicha without a musmach. So how do you do that? So the Rambam says, oh, it's simple. All you need to do is get all of the rabbis in the world to agree that somebody should have smicha, and then all the rabbis in the world together can give that person smicha, even though none of them have smicha. So the Rabbanim in Tzfat said, we're pretty much all the rabbis in the world, and they said, we're going to give some people smicha. And there were some very famous rabbis that had that smicha. A lot of rabbis said, wait, you're not all the rabbis in the world, because last I checked, I'm a rabbi too, and I don't remember signing on to this. Meaning the Rabbanim in Tzfat said, we're pretty much everybody. We're pretty much all the rabbis in the world. And Rabbanim Yerushalayim said, what are you talking about? How come you never consulted with us? No one ever asked us. We're rabbis too. But they did. So the Beis Yosef had smicha. The Al-Sheikh had smicha, you know, this controversial smicha. But anyway, most Rishonim assume that unless you have musmachim, unless you have some, it died out after three or four generations. We don't have it anymore, right? That smicha's gone. So we don't have any smicha anymore. We only have the fake smicha, the yora yora. So after three or four generations, it died out. We don't have it anymore. And therefore, most Rishonim hold, we can't blow shofar on Shabbos because you can only do it, b'makom, that there's a beis din of musmachim that could blow shofar. comes along Rav Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, who is not afraid to say a chiddush, right? He's not afraid to say something that's different, that goes against the trends, that's not widely accepted. And he says, you could do it, and you have to do it, and we need to blow shofar on Shabbos. And he had three basic points as to why he thinks that it's important. First of all, he says, the real din was that after that in Yerushalayim, they would blow shofar on Shabbos. Outside of Yerushalayim, they didn't blow shofar on Shabbos. It's just that after the Churban, we didn't really have access to Yerushalayim. So that's where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai came along and said, okay, the closest approximation that we have to Yerushalayim is a place that has a Beis Din. Meaning, because what's special about Yerushalayim? Ki Mitzion, you know the end of the Pasuk? Teitze Torah, right? Yerushalayim is the center of Torah. It's the place where all Torah comes from. That's where you blow shofar on Shabbos. When we don't have Yerushalayim, we need to find other places that are centers of Torah. What are other places that are centers of Torah? Places that have a Beis Din. That makes it a Torah environment. And therefore, you could blow shofar there. But says Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, in 1880, we have Yerushalayim. Not under Jewish control, but we have access to Yerushalayim. We could actually go to Yerushalayim itself. So we could blow shofar there in Yerushalayim. So you don't need the whole Beis Din business. The whole Beis Din business was when there's no Yerushalayim, but now there is Yerushalayim. That was his first point. His second point is that it was very clear from the first Mishnah, the fourth paragraph of Rosh Hashanah, that Chazal did not want shofar and Shabbos to go away entirely. Right? Because what did they do? They were mesakin kol mokum sheyesh bo Beis Din, or maybe only in Yavne, but they always wanted it somewhere. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, after the Churban Abayis, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a series of takanos that were all aimed at keeping the dinim that we had, certain Beis HaMikdash related dinim, keeping them intact even when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. For example, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a takana that even though the din is, if you read a Chumash, the din is that on Sukkot you take Dalad Minim for only one day outside of the Mikdash. In the Mikdash you do for a whole week. But outside of the Mikdash, ulakachtam lachem, what are the next words in the Pasuk? Ulakachtam lachem, anyone know? Bayom HaRishon, creates other, etc. That only on the first day of Sukkot you take Lulav. It's a Pasuk in the Torah. So why do we take Lulav for 7 days? Because Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a takana. Remember that in the Mikdash we used to take it for 7 days, and therefore, midrabanan, we should try to keep alive some of those dinim that we did in the Mikdash. So says Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, clearly they wanted shofar to be blown somewhere on Shabbos. And that's why they said Malkum Sheish Bezin. So you're going to tell me, yeah, but nowadays there are no qualified batidin, so we're not going to blow shofar anywhere on Shabbos? That clearly wasn't the goal and the aim of the Tanaim. The Tanoim very much wanted us to blow shofar somewhere on Shabbos. And he says, yeah, you have to at least say that it's a suffix, right? It's at least a suffix. So what's the rule when you're not sure? Should I do something? Should I not do something? As far as mitzvahs are concerned? Don't do it. Yes, do it. What's the rule? I mean, it's at least a suffix whether we should be blowing shofar on Shabbos. He says, you may not love my arguments, but it's at least a suffix. So what's the rule of a suffix? No, but most basic rule in learning. Savik daraisa l'chumra, savik darabana l'kula. The mitzvah of tkiyah shofar on Rosh Hashanah is a mitzvah. What kind of mitzvah? Mitzvah of tkiyah shofar on Rosh Hashanah. This is important. Mitzvah daraisa. It's a pasuk, right? You have to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. This shouldn't be news to you. You have to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. It's a mitzvah daraisa. And what do we say? It's the first day of Rosh Hashanah. For sure, mitzvah daraisa. For sure, mitzvah daraisa. So he says, so it's you have a suffix whether you should perform this mitzvah daraisa? Do it. Suffix daraisa l'chumra. And he said, but you're going to tell me that there might be an isser to do it because there's an isser d'rabanan that we don't blow shofar on Shabbos. Right? He says, yeah, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. That's a suffix. Suffix d'rabanan l'kula. So Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger said, we got to do it. We got to blow shofar on Shabbos. No one agreed with him. I mean, very few people agreed with him. And they were not going to do it. But the question then became, all right, he's doing his thing, right? Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger is going to be blowing shofar on Shabbos. Whatever the year it was, 1880 or whatever year it was, that Rosh Hashanah, Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger is going to be blowing shofar on Shabbos. So the question then became, what all the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim were discussing is, what's their question? Should we go? Should we show up and at least listen? Meaning, In a chinami, we wouldn't do it because that's crazy. But he's doing it anyway. He might be violating an isser. There's no isser to hear a shofar. And the upside is, what's the upside? You get a mitzvah. So should we go? Should we listen? The Aderes, who was one of the Gedolim of Yerushalayim at the time, said that he didn't agree with Rosh Salzinger, but the Aderes then got very, very sick. Aderes is an interesting story. Anyone know who the Aderes was? Rav Cook's father-in-law. The Aderes was Rav Cook's father-in-law. He was brought to Yerushalayim to replace Rav Shmuel Salant as the Rav of Yerushalayim. Rav Shmuel Salant was getting old. He was a big, big Talmud Chacham, and he was getting old. And they wanted to bring in an assistant rabbi. You know, some shul sometimes, as the rabbi gets older, they bring in a young assistant rabbi, and the plan is to sort of like phase the old rabbi out, and the young assistant will take over, right? So they brought in this assistant rabbi to ultimately take over for Shmuel Salant. As it turns out, they got him an apartment, everything. As it turns out, Shmuel Salant lived to like 95 or something. The Aderes sadly died when he was like 50. So he died before Shmuel Salant. So he never actually took over. He writes in one of his letters that he thinks what killed him is that they got him an apartment overlooking Har HaBayis. And he was able to see the Makom HaMikdash B'Chorbano from his window of his apartment. And he said, I don't know how you can live like that, meaning seeing such Chorban every single day. So he felt that it killed him, that it destroyed him. It was either that or cancer. But, you know, so he died, Nebuch, at a very young age. So the Aderes, as he was dying, the Aderes said that he doesn't agree with Rav Kivi Yosef Schlesinger, but it might be his last chance to hear shofar, because he's not gonna hear shofar the following year. He's not gonna be around. So he thought about going. It's unclear whether he did or didn't go, but at least he thought about going. So now the question becomes, okay, so let's talk about this. Is there any benefit in going to such a thing? So it's important to understand the background. Why don't we blow shofar on Shabbos? I mean, what do we lose? So the Gemara has a hava mina that it's a din d'oraisa that we don't blow shofar on Shabbos, because the pasuk doesn't only call Rosh Hashanah a yom trua, it also calls it a day of zichron trua. Zichron implies some remembrance of shofar. So when is it zichron trua, when is it yom trua? So the Gemara originally thinks maybe when Rosh Hashanah is on a weekday, it's a yom trua. When Rosh Hashanah is on a Shabbos, it's zichron trua. But then the Gemara ultimately comes to the conclusion, like you just said, that you might carry, that it's really a din midrabanan. We don't blow shofar on Shabbos because we're afraid Shema Yelich Esobaki Lilmod, you might not be a great expert in how to blow shofar, and you're on for that morning, you're supposed to blow shofar for the whole shul, so you want to go to your shofar teacher to teach you early in the morning. You can go, you know, if davening starts at 8, you'll go at 7 to your shofar teacher to get some last minute lessons on blowing shofar, and when you do that, you're going to bring your shofar along with you, you're going to end up carrying it Dalet Amos Perusha Sarabim, it's going to be a violation of carrying on Shabbos. Yontif wouldn't be such a problem because you're allowed to carry things that you need on Yontif. There is an Isra of Hotzah on Yontif, but anything that has any sort of Tzorech Hayom, you're allowed to carry on Yontif. So that would be a Tzorech Hayom, you'd be allowed to carry. But for Shabbos, it's going to be a problem, and therefore you're not allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos because we're afraid that someone might come to carry. So now the question becomes, okay, so the Rabbanim made such a din that you're not allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos. If you do it, do you get the mitzvah? If you do something that the Rabbanan told you, don't do this mitzvah. The Rabbanan are allowed to tell you, don't do this mitzvah. The Rabbanan said, where else do we have that the Rabbanan tells not to do a mitzvah? So it's not only shofar on Shabbos. What? Megillah. Lulav. Right? Those are the three places. Lulav, if the first day of Sukkot falls out on Shabbos, even if the first day of Sukkot falls out on Shabbos, any day of Sukkot falls out on Shabbos, we don't take lulav on Shabbos. If the first day falls out on Shabbos, it's mitzvah d'oraisa to take lulav. And we don't do it. We don't do it on Shabbos. Why? Because I might carry my lulav for Amos and Rosh Hashanah. I might violate an isser of carrying. So the Rabbanan made a din not to do it. So the question became, when the Rabbanan make a din not to do something, not to do a mitzvah, and I do it anyway, I defy the Rabbanan and I do it anyway, do I at least get credit for the mitzvah? So what do you think? Should you? Shouldn't you? Why not? It's a mitzvah ba aveira kind of thing. Yeah. Now, the mitzvah is a mitzvah daraisa. The aveira is an only aveira drabanan. So the question is, do the rabbanan have that kind of power? Meaning they can tell me, we know that they have the Yesh Koch Biar Chum Lakar Davar Min HaTorah B'Shevi Alta said, the Chum have the power to tell me, don't do this mitzvah Daraisa. But do they have the power to tell me, and if you do it, you're not even getting credit for it. It's not even a Kiyuma mitzvah. Can they go that far? That's really the question. Yeah?
The term Shev Al Tasas means that you sit down and you don't do it, but that implies that there still is something to do, they're just telling you don't do it.
Right, so we use the term Shev Al Tasas because sometimes the Chum might want to tell you to violate an Isser Bekumva Aseh by telling you to actively violate an Isser, and that's what we're told. No, the Rabbanon are definitely not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to tell you to actively violate an Isser. They're only allowed to tell you to passively violate an Isser. But meaning that's why we use the terminology Shevi Al Tasah, not because if you do it that it necessarily counts, just to say that like that's the limit of the Rabbanan's power in terms of what they could tell you not to do. So this is like the $1 million question. Why does it matter if you get credit for it or not? Should I go listen? Right? Meaning, if the guy is just doing an Aveira and there's no mitzvah whatsoever, right? Whatever he's doing is not a mitzvah anyway because the Rabbanan told him not to do it, then there's no point. I'm just going to give an audience for an Aveira. A guy's going to go do an Aveira and we're going to have a whole crowd gather around and watch him be Mechal Shabbos. That would be terrible. You know that you're not supposed to even give an audience for an Aveira. My brother's a Moel in Northern California, in San Jose, California. So oftentimes, there are a lot of Israelis that move to Northern California, you know, the tech industry, this and that. So a lot of times, there are non-frum Israelis that want to give their kids a bris milah. So when a baby's born on Shabbos, we normally do milah on Shabbos, right? You'll do bris milah on Shabbos, and it's not chil Shabbos. You're allowed to do that. But very often, if it's a non-frum person doing a milah on Shabbos, they'll also have a photographer there, and they'll also, have a whole, everyone will drive, and it'll be full of chil Shabbos. There'll be music, they'll do it. So the shaila is, should my brother tell them, nah, the right time to do the bris is on Sunday, right? And that way, not do the milah on Shabbos, where you can have all this other stuff. And part of it is, it's one thing that people are being mechal Shabbos, but to make a whole audience and a show of it where I'm going to now witness Chil Shabbos and everyone's going to watch the Chil Shabbos, that's not okay either. You're not supposed to, meaning much like we have a din of Barav Am Hadras Melech. What's Barav Am Hadras Melech? Where do we apply that? What does that mean? Megillah. Right, by Megillah. We're doing a mitzvah. It's better to do a mitzvah in a crowd, right? Because that's a great Kiddushim Shemayim. A whole crowd gets together to do a mitzvah. That's awesome. So just as much as it's a kiddush shem shemayim for a whole crowd to get together to do a mitzvah, it's a chil shem shemayim to provide an audience for an aveira, right? So we don't want to provide an audience for an aveira. So if the guy is doing something that's not a mitzvah at all, to go and listen to him would be terrible. I'm just providing an audience for an aveira. But if he's getting credit for a mitzvah, then maybe I can get the mitzvah without doing the Aveira. I'll just listen to the shofar. He's the one doing the Aveira of blowing it. But I'm going to get the mitzvah anyway because I'm just listening, and maybe I should go. So that was the question. Now, there are other nafkaminas, whether it's a... Yeah.
If you're listening to the shofar, do you have kavanas to yotze?
Yes.
So if it's really an Aveira, would you have kavanas to yotze also be an Aveira?
No, because the Aveira is not to blow shofar on Shabbos. The Aveira is not to... is not an aveira of being mekayim in the mitzvah. So the din of shomea ka'oneh is not the same as shlichus, and it could be that it doesn't even work through shomea ka'oneh when it comes to shofar. That's a whole nother sugya. It could be that the mitzvah of shofar is not that you have to blow the shofar and then when you hear it, it's as if you blew it. It could be that the mitzvah of shofar is to be shomea shofar. Meaning it's not like a technicality, there's a halachic thing called Shamea Keona, and therefore it's like I blew it. No, the mitzvah is to hear it. Yeah.
Is there really an issue of lifnei iver by going to the
shofar? If he's going to do it anyway, it's probably not lifnei iver, because I'm not causing him to do it, I'm not helping him do it. Now, it could be an issue of encouraging an aveira, meaning the more people that come, the more he'll be encouraged to do it. Right? The Gemara tells us, the Mishnah tells us, that if you see someone plowing his field during Shemitah, you're not supposed to say, good luck plowing today, right? I mean, you're not supposed to encourage an aveira. Once had a guy in my shul told me that it was a snowy winter Shabbos many years ago, and he came home from shul, and his Jewish neighbor had plowed with his snowblower his entire driveway and walkway, so on Shabbos morning. So he like wanted to say thank you, but how do you say thank you to a Jew who's Mechal Shabbos to clear your walkway, right? Meaning maybe even saying thank you, it's not Lifnei Iver, but it's encouraging of an Avera. So you have to like think of the right way to approach that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So practically, it seems like a terrible idea to go for all of these reasons, right? It seems like a terrible idea to go. But, you know, think of yourself as the Aderes, right? Last year alive, your last chance at Shofar Midoraisa, right? Meaning, I won't tell anyone. I'm just going to go, I'll hide, you know? I'll put on a baseball cap and, you know, sunglasses or whatever. And, you know, what? Achorei Hageder. That's what the Aderes said he was going to do. So there are other nafkaminas as to whether it's a mitzvah or not. I mean, for example, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank in Mikraya Kodesh. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was the Rav of Yerushalayim. He was a big, big, big Talmud Chacham. Rav Yonason Sachs is the great-grandson of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. You ever hear Rav Sachs came a call this summer, right? So like when you hear Rav Sachs speak, it's like jaw-dropping, no? It's like... people can know Torah that well, like that fluently. So, like, he grew up hearing stories about the Zayde, about Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, about his great grandfather. He said that Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, when Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, every Shabbos would review the entire Masechah Shabbos, not Mishnayos, Gemara, the entire Masechah Shabbos every Shabbos. He said during his year of Avelos, he learned Masechah Beitza. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, during his year of Avelos for his mother or father, he learned Maseches Beitza every day of the year of Avelos, in addition to his other responsibilities. 40 blad Maseches Beitza every day. So this is, Rav Sachs told us when he was in his year of Avelos for his mother, he said, I didn't do every day, but I tried to do something similar. He didn't tell us what exactly that was, but probably every other day or every week. I don't know, but you know, he did something similar. But anyway, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank writes, what if somebody does it thinking it's mutter? Should you listen? Meaning this is a nafkamina. Another nafkamina that's quoted, Rav Shlomo Kluger writes, would you say a Shechianu on the second day of Rosh Hashanah according to those opinions that you normally don't say a Shechianu on both days? Meaning, there are some that hold that when you blow shofar on both days, that the second day you don't say a Shechianu. But if you only blow shofar on one day, meaning let's say like we're going to do this year, we're only blowing shofar on the second day, then for sure you say a Shechianu on the second day. What if you blew shofar on Shabbos on the first day? Do you say a Shechianu on the second day? So if you hold that when you blew shofar on Shabbos on the first day, you got a mitzvah, then no, it's too late. You don't say a Shechianu. But if you didn't get a mitzvah, so this is your first time doing the mitzvah, so you do say a Shechianu. Another nafkamina is, what if you started blowing shofar, you blew tkiya, shvarim, trua, and then someone says, oh my God, it's Shabbos, we're not supposed to be doing this. Should you at least get one more tkiya in? Meaning otherwise you will have done the tkiya, shvarim, trua, and you said a bracha beforehand, it's going to be a bracha levatala. But at least if you get a set in, it's not going to be a bracha levatala. But if it's not a mitzvah, then anyway it's a bracha levatala. Just say your baruch shem kol machzor li'olam ved and move on with your day. Right, enjoy your challenge. You know, but it's not going to be so. But if it's a mitzvah, you could save the bracha levatala by blowing that last kiyah. Right, that might be another nafkamina. So there is a sefer called Drush V'Chiddush, written by Rabbi Kiva Eger. We have a minute and a half left, so we're about to get to the actual sugya. I guess you know you'll learn it some other time. But there is a sefer Drush V'Chiddush written by Rabbi Kiva Eger. Rabbi Kiva Eger writes, "You still fulfill the mitzvah d'oraisa." Whoa. You still fulfill the mitzvah d'oraisa, even though the Rabbanan told you not to do it. So this is another sefer called Kava de Kashiasa. Kava de Kashiasa is less known than Rabbi Kiva Eger. Kava de Kashiasa was written by the author of the Chelkas Yoav. The Chelkas Yoav is a Talmud of the Avnei Nezer. And in the back of his Tshuva Sefer, he has two pages, or three or four pages, of 103 questions that he's bothered by. It's just a list of 103 kashas that he has. The Gemara is an expression called kava de kashiasa. The Gemara uses it in the context of kava, meaning a kav, a certain measure of straw, in whatever context it is. It's in a dine mamonis context. So this Chelkas Yoav did a play on words. Kava, kuf, beis, aleph, de kashiasa. He says, I have 103 questions. Kuf is gematria 100, beis, gematria 2, aleph, gematria 1, so it's 103. Kava, the kashyasa of kashas that I have, not straw, but kashas that I have. So that was his gimmick. He put out a sefer of 103 kashas. The only thing all 103 kashas have in common is that he doesn't know the answer to any of them. right? That's all they have in common. It's just a random collection of kashas. Now, of course, the Jewish people, being the Jewish people, cannot hear look at a sefer called Kavod HaKashyas and just let that be, right? So everyone had to come up with answers. It was a great gimmick. It worked. He got everyone talking about his sefer. So now you'll find a sefer out there called Kavod HaTerutza, Kavod HaYeshuva, right? There, everyone came out with their own sefers, with their own svarim, answering all of his kashas. But one of his kashas is on this Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and he says, no, the Rabbanan, when the Rabbanan tell you not to do something, they're not just telling you not to do something, they're telling you that you don't have the capacity to do it. So when the Rabbanan tell you not to blow shofar, and he has rayas like this, which we're not going to be able to get to, when the Rabbanan tell you not to blow shofar on Shabbos, they're not telling you, just don't do it. They're telling you, you think you have the capacity to do the mitzvah? You don't have the capacity to do the mitzvah. You're not blessed with the ability to do the mitzvah. And therefore, it's an absolute zero if you do it. So that's where the real lumdus is. So maybe if we have another opportunity for another shir, we can get to the real lumdus of what the machlokas Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Kavod HaKashyasa is all about. But at least we got a little bit of the history. Okay, everyone have a great day. Enjoy the rest of your summer.